All right, everybody, welcome, welcome here. Matthew Majinskas, your host from the Baltics, as always, joined here by my co-host Alec Harris from Halo Privacy and the Eastern U.S. Alec, what's going on?
What's up, guys? I dressed up for everyone. This is a very important
thank you.
Episode.
Thank you for doing
You're
that. happy Friday.
And guys,
here we have audio only. We have Peter Todd, well-known Bitcoin researcher, open timestamps, and a big supporter of Ukraine. Very happy to have him on the show. Going to talk a lot about that today. So, Peter, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So we actually talked with you a little less than 2 years ago. Tomorrow, from this recording, February 24th, will be the two-year anniversary of the full-scale invasion. And Monday, this last Monday, was the 10-year anniversary of Crimea invasion by Russia. So let's try to also maybe link this up with people in our space, Bitcoiners. It's my impression that the Venn diagram between supporting Ukraine and supporting Bitcoin is quite small. I don't know if you feel that way. Do you feel that way?
I mean, it probably depends on where in the world you're talking about, but certainly on the Twitter space, I think it's a lot smaller than it should be.
Agreed. Agreed. Why? What can we do about that? And why do you think it is so small? Is it just there's many, you know, just two loud voices and the people that really care aren't speaking up?
This is my pinned tweet on Twitter, but I think the big issue is just idiotic contrarianism. You know, I think the thing with Bitcoin is it really attracts people who are contrarians, and a lot of contrarianism is just reflexive reaction to whatever the mainstream thinks is right. You know, and sometimes this happens to be correct, other times it happens to go into total nuttiness. I mean, you know, one extreme branch of contrarianism is like flat earth stuff and whatnot, which is just ridiculous. And like I said in my pinned tweets, you know, the hardest part about being a good contrarian is knowing when the mainstream is right.
You know, we actually touched on this last time we spoke, and I don't know if you remember, a good example of this, I think, is Bruce Fenton. I mentioned him 2 years ago, and I mentioned him to you recently as we were talking about doing this interview. He has the same, so this is even a bit beyond the contrarianism. There's a lot of people that are just so disillusioned with the West that they're just like, it's all bad. I don't know. I don't know anything about Ukraine. I don't want to know. How can I know? These are probably fake pictures. And the amazing thing is, I mentioned this 2 years ago, he's the same person, Bruce Fenton, well-known, ran for Senate, I believe. You know, it's the same view, is that, how can I know? I don't know anything. This is, you know, they're probably fake pictures. And he was going on this to you 2 years ago, the same morning that the Bucha revelations came to light. Now, he did not know that at the time. You didn't either. But it's, you know, at what point are you going to believe pictures and satellite images and the like? Or is it just going to get even worse with AI?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think AI, like, if anything, I think what all of this has shown is that you don't need AI to get big chunks of the population just reflexively disbelieve things. You know, like I haven't actually seen AI play a major part in any of this, with the more recent exception of Israel. There'd be more AI stuff coming out of Israel lately with Gaza. But, you know, with Russia, I mean, that doesn't seem necessary to get people to say all kinds of ridiculous stuff.
Good point. Let's table the AI for now and Gaza. I do want to ask you about that. But with Russia here, 2 years now, full scale, 10 years, all of us in Eastern Europe have been warning about this since the 90s, that this was going to happen again. What are your thoughts? I mean, people just don't understand private property. They don't understand sovereign borders. Why aren't even more people up in arms about what's happening?
Well, you know, if I was going to take the big picture view, I would say, you know, the number one reason is cowardice because Russia has nukes. I think if you look at it in the very big picture, like a good comparison here is compare this to what happened in the first Gulf War, where Saddam Hussein invades his neighbor. The rest of the world kind of says, fuck this. you know, we're not going to allow this to happen. And they basically stopped short of bombing Iraq back to the Stone Age. You know, and I think that was a very easy decision to make because there really weren't that many consequences for everyone going after Iraq at that time. You know, they didn't have weapons that could, I mean, of course, famously, they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. So it was quite a safe thing to say, well, screw this, we're going to go punish this, and you're just not allowed to do that. Whereas Russia, I think, you know, because of the sort of boogeyman, people have just enough cowardness that you get all these sort of downstream effects from it. You know, if you took away Russia's nuclear weapons, I don't think you would get this kind of, you know, this kind of thing playing out in the same way. I think you would get a much stronger response. But again, I call this cowardice.
It also, I think, I see this a lot from, you know, again, kind of overlapping circles, libertarians in the U.S., you know, the Dave Smiths, the Scott Hortons of the world, they're simply saying, you know, why are we picking a fight with Russia? Why are we doing this? Completely ignoring the fact that Ukraine's sovereign borders have been invaded for 10 years now, but 2 years in a more extreme manner. And if you do want to come down to some principle here, international law, borders, sovereignty, human rights, the fact that the nuclear blackmail seems to triumph over even supposedly diehard, consistent libertarians is interesting. It's almost like states' rights and sovereignty means nothing then, because if Russia wants her sphere of influence back from the Soviet Union or the Tsarist times, which none of us want, and you know, many countries were well bigger before the Moscow Duchy anyway, if we want to do some real history, like going back to Putin's Tucker interview. But the point is, why is it that people sort of completely cower and they actually lose their principles, in my opinion? Loss of principle.
So, you know, with libertarians specifically, and I want to be clear, I'm only talking about, you know, the libertarian crowd. I think an issue that is brought up here is libertarian ideology at extremes doesn't really work properly, because when you pit, you know, sort of libertarian ideology against states, the fact is a lot of big states have a lot of power, and there isn't a reasonable way to defeat those states in a war without having a whole lot of what's effectively a state. You know, there is no way to go up in a full-scale war against a country like the size of Russia without having something that's going to look pretty much like a government. And I think a lot of libertarians for the extremist side of it just, you know, just are dismayed about this and aren't willing to go accept reality that, you know, their ideology doesn't work at the extremes. Now, you know, I would call myself certainly a soft libertarian. Like, you know, this is just an extreme case of something that, you know, generally works pretty well. And of course, within the war, the way it's played out, I think actually shows libertarian ideology works pretty well in general. When you look at how military procurement in Ukraine has operated and so on. But at the extremes, it just exposes flaws in their ideas. And I think it's much easier to just start babbling on about, you know, oh, you know, maybe Russia isn't the bad guys, or, you know, maybe we shouldn't pick a fight and all this. It's, you know, it's just cowardice of refusing to admit that, well, maybe your positions don't work properly at the extremes.
I hear a lot of arguments that this could have been a war avoided. You know, there was time for diplomacy in 2-3 years ago, right? There were negotiations that could have preempted this war. And this is all post-Crimea, right? But like pre-invasion of the Donbass. And so one of the arguments I hear is, well, we could have avoided this war, so why are we funding it now? Which I think there's like sort of a flaw inherently in that argument. But what do you make of the, like, it was our fault that this war happened? It was the West's fault that this war happened.
You know, I think a thing there is when you say diplomacy, you always got a question, well, what are you giving up? Now, you can always go and avoid war by diplomacy in the sense that you can always just go give the aggressor what they want. You do this endlessly. I mean, you know, I like to make the analogy to the defund the police movement. I think a lot of the way Ukraine discussion plays out is actually very similar to the defund the police movement, where the idea of, well, we'll just go talk it out. We'll just go give the people what they want. You know, we'll keep on backing away from our positions. that's not dissimilar to the idea of the defund police movement, where you just say, well, what if crime, you know, wasn't illegal? What if we go give these people the stuff they want? I mean, at some point you got to say, well, this isn't worth it. And continually giving up, you know, giving up property, giving up terrain because someone, you know, powerful wants it. Well, yeah, that's diplomacy, but it's also not very useful. And at some point, it makes sense to fight for what you have.
One of the additional arguments there is that if the West or if NATO had taken NATO off the table for Ukraine, then Russia wouldn't have been forced to invade, right? Which, again, we can, the flaws are evident. But what do you make of the sort of encroachment of NATO argument?
Well, Russia's the one who attacked first. I mean, you know, the biggest factor leading to the expansion of NATO has been Russian aggression. There's, you know, there's no reason to join NATO, given the political annoyance of all this, except for the fact that if you don't join NATO, Russia will probably invade you at some point. I mean, look at how after the recent full-scale invasion picked up, suddenly you get, what is it, two more? Finland joined pretty quickly, and I believe it's Sweden is still in the process, but will probably join NATO. I mean, you know, that's a pretty quick cause and effect there. And, you know, you even get Switzerland going and, not joining NATO, going and changing some of its tenets of neutrality. Because like I mentioned to Giacomo the other day on Twitter, Russia is just so evil that even a neutral country like Sweden can't look the other way.
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually, because there's a lot of Russian assets there in Switzerland. Putin's mistress as well is there, as far as I know, as far as I heard last. Very interesting. Obviously agree with you on all that. And being in Eastern Europe, living so close to the fire, of course, we're not suffering nearly as much as Ukrainians, but you know, the stress levels are rising very much for all of us here. And it's one of these things where I think Europeans, well, for sure Europeans this year are realizing that they need to up their support, armaments, be more innovative. They can't rely on the United States to always do everything. What do you make, though, of the bluster? I don't want to get too much into the real politic of it all, but what do you make of the bluster, again, from Trump, you know, saying he's not going to support if you don't pay? And by the way, all the Eastern European nations do pay the 2% threshold. But what do you make of the bluster and just the way that it seems like the U.S. might go back to this sort of isolationist view?
I mean, the unfortunate thing about that is Trump does have a point. Well, you know, Eastern European nations have been paying even more than their fair share. A lot of other European nations haven't been. And he is right on that. And, you know, how do you fix that problem? Like, there isn't easy solutions there. You know, maybe Trump's approach isn't the wrong one, but it is an approach. And it's an approach where you could see it potentially working by just forcing, you know, other countries. I think Belgium is the one who pays, you know, contributes the least in terms of arms for NATO. But, you know, it's, if I remember correctly, the number for them was a bit under 1%. Well, how do you get them to go and fund more military? At some point, a reasonable strategy can be to say, well, look, we're not going to go fund you if bad things happen. You're going to have to do it yourself. But yeah, there's no easy solutions there.
Well, so about, again, the kind of like disengagement crowd, certainly in the US, and I know there's cohorts of that in the EU as well, would say, we could all save a bunch of money. Let's just let the Russians have the Donbass. That's all they wanted anyway. And I think that overlooks the, you know, domino effect of giving them what they want, which we've already discussed a bit. But
yeah,
you know, the other argument, the other counterpoint is Russia needs to be stopped now, because they will have more strength, more land, more resources as their encroachment, you know, moves further west, and it makes their attack on NATO more powerful, closer to NATO borders, and gives them time to reconstitute.
Yep.
And so, you know, how, I guess, what would you say to that?
Well, you know, I have to agree. It's cheap to go and, you know, push them while they're down. Like, you know, war in general tends to be an economic thing where the question is, what level of spending or, you know, economic resources can you put towards war? And the thing with war is all of this stuff, the equations of how this plays out all has exponentials in it. You know, right now is the time to be doing things like destroying Russia's electricity grid, Russia's infrastructure, because that is the sort of exponent that lets them go rebuild. You know, with war, you tend to go win not by carefully managing escalation or so on. You tend to win by going all in and destroying your enemy as quickly as possible before they have a chance to do anything about it.
Which is a major fuck up from last year, and that we gave them.
Oh yeah.
Year after the
it's enormous fuck up.
2022 to regroup.
I mean, it's, you know, and it's such an obvious fuck up that, like, it's very hard to imagine people making that fuck up for good reasons, at least internally in sort of the military command of the U.S. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with how people like Sullivan go approach this stuff, to the point where you really got to ask, are they really like playing on the side of the U.S. or are they playing their own game for their own purposes? And I'm inclined to think it's the latter. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean like the Russian agents or anything, but it could easily mean like what they're actually doing is trying to ensure their own job security by making sure that this problem continues to be a problem for long periods of time. You know, and that kind of bad incentive probably explains a lot of what bureaucracies do in general, and it probably explains what's happening here.
I want to talk about the recent news of Navalny last week, a week ago exactly, actually, where his news of his death was reported. I'm pretty much with you, Peter. I mean, I'm going to support Ukraine no matter what, and their views are pretty much unsympathetic to a failed Russian liberal cause, which Navalny was part of. At the same time, I will give them that, all right, I mean, he was up against something that seemed insurmountable, and he gave his life for it. And I certainly don't want to denigrate that, but, you know, I don't think people understand how serious that is for Ukraine. I know you've been there. I mean, I've been there many times, but can you just talk about that? Like, what, you know, talk about that relationship between perhaps the Russian liberals, perhaps what people in the West are seeing on Twitter, what they think and what, you know, Ukrainians are actually going through.
Well, I mean, I think the big thing I'd say to that is, you know, you're making an assumption by saying that these people are liberal. Like, a good way to go manage opposition is to go have puppet oppositions. And in a country like Russia, it's perfectly plausible that Navalny was just a managed puppet opposition. And that the reason why he happened to die this time around was that situations changed a bit. And Putin, you know, for whatever reason, thought he could get more advantage by killing the guy. Doesn't mean that he's on our side or even true opposition. You know, and it's
also,
one of the things.
It also doesn't not mean that, though, correct?
Well, it doesn't necessarily not mean, but, you know, it's like, I think a good way to think about this is, given how plausible that is and how ineffectual that opposition actually is, I mean, does it really matter which way it actually played out? Like, the end result is supporting Russian opposition doesn't seem to do much. With the one exception of supporting Russian opposition that actually sabotages Russia from within in real concrete ways. You know, a good example being like Russian defectors who actually joined up with the Ukrainian military and are actually fighting and doing something useful. But, you know, in general, like focusing on Russian opposition, I think just falls into the diplomacy trap of assuming that there is a diplomatic method that actually works. And, you know, like many Ukrainians have pointed out, one way to read Navalny's views is that he was an anti-corruption campaigner, not actually a liberal. You know, he wanted to see Russia as being less corrupt and more able to be, you know, what Russians wanted it to be. And unfortunately, a lot of Russians seem to want it to be an imperialistic state that goes and controls its neighbors and invades them. And, you know, the best way to go fix that is to destroy the ability of them to do that.
So here's the time where I have to tone into some of our libertarian Bitcoiner friends and ask the what about question. What about, you know, all the US's wars of conquest over the recent years and decades?
Well, I don't think you can fairly call what the US does wars of conquest. Because if they're wars of conquest, they would end with actually taking over governments and places in a meaningful way. You know, it's notable that the U.S., the way Iraq played out was not that the U.S. took over Iraq and controlled it. It's that the U.S. found ways to, you know, give Iraq some, like, some kind of democratic governance where they could go and make their own decisions again. And not necessarily good decisions. I mean, similarly, the way that, you know, resources have played out in Iraq and Afghanistan is not being that the U.S. comes in and takes those resources for the U.S. It's that U.S. creates conditions where, you know, other partners can reasonably fairly bid on helping Iraq get more oil out of the ground and sell it for themselves. I mean, the average Iraqi does, you know, does get benefits out of all this stuff. Whether or not they use those benefits for good, well, you know, that's a whole question there. But this doesn't just, this just doesn't play out like what Russia's doing.
Go on. I agree with you, but go on.
Yeah. Well, you know, by comparison, like by comparison, well, what does Iraq do in Ukraine? Well, they're not setting up democratic institutions where Ukrainians in, you know, occupied territory can actually have a fair vote. No, they're bringing in Russians to go and, yeah, like they're bringing in Russians to go take advantage of this and figuring out ways to kick out, kill, and marginalize Ukrainians in the area. I mean, that, you know, that's a war of conquest. And the U.S. just doesn't do that. Now, the U.S. certainly has a lot of, you know, gains a lot of benefits from its wars. So, I mean, one good example being the U.S. seems to do a pretty good job at eliminating the threat of Islamic terrorism for quite a while. And most of that was done by simply killing the guys. I mean, you know, if you look at early Afghan war, U.S. and its allies killed something like roughly 50% of the entire Taliban within a few months. And had all they done was just left at that point, they probably would have gotten pretty much all the benefit from the U.S. But because of how U.S. politics plays out, well, now you got to go do the nation building. Now you got to spend, you know, what is it, $10 trillion in the next 20 years. And, you know, eventually the Taliban gets back in power. But certainly the beginning of that clearly benefited the U.S. by killing the people who had gone and, you know, killed a bunch of people on 9/11. Not necessarily very well, because, of course, then they would have had to go after the Saudis. But, you know, at least there's some degree of benefit that makes sense there. But, you know, can you call it a war of conquest? No, you just can't.
So I was going to say, I think there's a huge difference between being militaristic, which the U.S. definitely is, and that's been ingrained in kind of the U.S. ethos forever, and being, you know, seeking empire, which I don't think the U.S. does, and hasn't for a long time, right? And we've expanded between the Atlantic and the Pacific, right? That's what the U.S. has done, and there isn't anything more to grab there. And I think you're right. The evidence is in this kind of like post clearing of hostile towns, regions, et cetera, where we come in with like development money and USAID and community building. And it doesn't usually work, right? But it shows the intent is to, you know, in Afghanistan, we spend all this money, you know, trying to empower women to have economic power and to have markets where they're represented and their goods are traded and sold. And obviously, you know, none of that has been enduring, but that's what it looks like after the U.S. rolls through with Bradley's. That's a much different post-fact. But I think, well, a lot of times what people see, which is what you were pointing at, is the very aggressive military front end where, you know, around the same period you were referring to, I think, I forget the exact stat, but it was something like once you became the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you had less than 30-day survival rate. And so no one wanted to be named number one of AQ because they would be named number one and then they would be targeted and killed. Named number one, targeted and killed. And we sow a lot of discontent that way. And a lot of the opinion of the U.S. globally, I think, comes from the kill your way into a new situation. I don't know. Like, I think it's a fraught foreign policy, but I don't think it deserves the same billing as the way that, you know, some of the Russians or others operate, for sure.
I mean, when you get down to it, a hell of a lot of U.S. soldiers have lost their lives in failed attempts at state building and failed attempts at Well, actually, you know, should they say often successful attempts at avoiding civilian casualties and so on. You know, the U.S. is reasonably good at conducting war in a way that doesn't kill a lot of quote-unquote civilians. And fact is, a lot of U.S. people have lost their lives because of this, you know. Now, has the outcome of that necessarily been good? Well, you know, there's debate there. But, like, the fact is, this is what the U.S. tries to do, not always perfectly, and that's just not something that Russia tries to do.
Yeah, I think a really good example of that is, I forget the name of the missile, right? But it's the one that doesn't have a munition warhead and the blades just open up. And so the reason that we have that is so to minimize collateral damage, both to property and lives. The Russians would never build that, right?
No, never.
Who cares, right? That's how they see it.
Yeah. No, like, Russia's approach there has been to go dredge up inaccurate 50-year-old weapons because, well, if you just send more of them, I mean, everything around there will be destroyed anyway. And, you know, and I should point out, too, I mean, in the context of, like, Ukraine, I mean, I would have no opposition to Ukraine going and using inaccurate weapons in the general direction of Russian targets because Russia has chosen to go fight, you know, a war of aggression, and any taxpayer in Russia is to a large degree responsible. I mean, I'd consider, you know, the way I view this ethically is like total war, in much the same way as that I have absolutely no qualms about how the Allies went and destroyed Dresden. You know, that the whole city was a valid military target as far as I'm concerned. Whereas I'd say, you know, in Russia's case, like, there is no such thing as a valid military target in Ukraine. The whole war is illegal.
I was just going to make a couple of those points exactly because the unfortunate thing for Ukraine is they don't have these endless supply of Soviet-era missiles that they don't care where they could go and they don't care if they hit an errant, you know, apartment block. But yes, it is absolutely legitimate to punch back on Russia proper for what they are doing. The problem is Ukraine doesn't have money, and ammunitions are running very, very low at the moment. And I mean, even from day one, there was information, you know, some people might remember the U.S. actually had pretty good intelligence that Ukraine was going to be invaded that week that it was. But from day one, the U.S. was withholding intelligence that it still knew about certain officers, where they were, you know, potential convoys. They were very cooperative with Ukraine, but they're still treating Russia as this near peer, which is what Ukraine has to deal with. I mean, the United States is not Ukraine. This is, you know, more to bolster what you guys were saying before. United States is not Ukraine. Ukraine is not the United States. You know, this is very difficult for them. So, yeah, kind of leads me to my next question. I wanted to ask you, what else do you think we can do? I sent you that tweet earlier from Bill Browder. He's going around talking about freezing Russian international reserves to pay for this, which also has very interesting parallels with Bitcoin. We can get to the Bitcoin part in a second, but or you can get to it now. What do you think about proposals like this? You know, freeze the reserves have already been frozen for 2 years, 300 billion of at least of international reserves of the Russian Central Bank in Europe and Euroclear. These are, you know, securities, German bonds, gilts, U.S. treasuries in various places. What do you think about actually confiscating them full stop and using them to pay?
I mean, I think all Russian assets should be confiscated. Like, it's, you know, there's a very clear criminality to this. And I think it's completely reasonable to go seize assets when you can to go and compensate for criminal actions. Now, you know, and I'll point out too, like, from a Bitcoin point of view, of course, an obvious possible outcome of this is that trust in fiat currency reserves goes down and more money goes into Bitcoin, which, you know, should be seen as a win-win. I mean, you know, not everything you do can necessarily be done twice, but you can take that action now and it makes sense to go do it. And Ukraine is the rightful beneficiary of all this money. In fact, I would even go as far as to go say, I mean, you know, again, if you are a Russian outside of Russia and you continue to go pay taxes in Russia, I'm happy to go call that a criminal act. You are supporting a war and you do have the option of refusing to go pay your taxes. You know, yeah, you might go lose some property back in Russia, but you are still doing the right thing, and we should expect people to do the right thing. Like, you know, tax evasion for Russians in Russia right now is a civic duty.
Hmm. That's a good point. There's 30 million, at least, Russians abroad. It's the third largest diaspora after Chinese and Indians.
Yep. Lots of them in Canada, that's for sure. I mean, you know, in my apartment building in Canada, Russian or Ukrainian, I can't tell the difference. But certainly in the past, like one or the other has been something like the second or third most common language I go here. And lots of them around.
Yeah.
It is different. Yeah. Yeah. I can't. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know which is which. And also I should point out, of course, just because you hear someone speaking Russian or Ukrainian in Canada doesn't mean they're still Russian or Ukrainian. You know, a lot of these people would have given up their Russian passports and potentially Ukrainian passports too to go and get Canadian passports. So, or for that matter, many of them were probably even born in Canada and it was actually the parents who came over. But, you know, it certainly is a very, a very wide diaspora.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you. I mean, we're already at a very interesting slippery slope for the state of world banks working together, world central banks working together and governing, you know, the monetary system. Bitcoin is playing a part in this. But the profits on the actual interest that's been paid on these bonds and stuff that Russia had held abroad has already been used. So we've already gotten to the point where we're ready to confiscate the profits of the frozen assets. It's just a question of whether the assets themselves. But then now I can hear all the libertarians chirping away like, oh, you're just ready to steal. You know, you don't have any respect for private property. Of course, ignoring the elephant of the room in the room that is the war on a sovereign territory. But nonetheless, Bitcoin is actually going to play an interesting part here. You know, Bill Browder, who is championing this, and who probably the number one Westerner that Vladimir Putin hates, do check him out, dear listener, if you haven't heard about him. But he hates Bitcoin. He doesn't understand it. He's a very wealthy philanthropist, made a lot of money in Russia. Now Putin hates him. He's ready to do everything he can for Ukraine, confiscate these assets, but he hates Bitcoin. He doesn't understand Bitcoin.
Well, I'd say, I think an interesting counterpoint to that question is, do I believe that like Bitcoiners should go seize Russian Bitcoin? And I'd say, no, that's not actually worth it. You know, the downsides of that to going and destroying, freedom of money is not worth it. Like there are actions that are much better idea than trying to go and, you know, seize Russian state Bitcoin by changing the Bitcoin protocol.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking about that protocol. Yeah. I was just saying simply, which is very difficult to do, which I think is very, it's a very, like Bitcoin is, I think, unbeknownst to many, could play a very interesting role in the outcome here, especially what happens to these frozen reserves, because it's never been done. If like this is the base level of the system here as far as assets.
I'm not sure about never being done. I would want to go fact check that. I am sure you could find examples of reserves being taken before. You know, certainly not at the scale, but
let's say at scale.
Yeah. Of course, you know, part of the reason why that would be unprecedented is simply because Russia is so big. Like, yeah. You know, the Russian economy is, I believe, at least like 10x bigger than Iraq would have been in the Gulf War, probably more. And there really aren't many. There's just not that many countries in the world that are as big as Russia.
And still 20x smaller than NATO, at least. So just to go back to your question.
Well, the famous example people like to give is how the entire Russian GDP is still smaller than Spain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So going back to your point earlier about cowardice, I think it's important, very important to keep in mind. I mean, this is unbelievable to me. And we can, well, Alec, did you have any more on
sort of Ukraine? Yeah, before we go into Bitcoin, which we should definitely do, and I think we're basically at the segue, but I wanted to talk a little bit, Peter, on the like the cyber side and the disinformation side of the warfare, because I think I think it's pervasive. I think the Russians are actually very effective in that domain. In the US, we had a almost total cellular outage yesterday affecting AT&T, T-Mobile, US Cellular, and Verizon to varying degrees, with AT&T being the most affected. We don't know, you know, where that came from, right? But we know previous to the invasion, there were at least two full grid power attacks that were kind of like test attacks by the Russians on Ukrainian power grids. And we know through leaked Russian documents and through research that they will spend billions on disinformation campaigns. They had one a counter Ukrainian disinformation campaign called Maidan 3. They supposedly spent $1.6 billion on. $250 million of that was purely on just Telegram bots, right? $250 million on Telegram bots. And, you know, there's the Russian influence on elections, you know, Dutch referendum, EU, US, German elections, empowering far right narratives, like, you know, they've done it all. And I thought it was funny that Putin told Tucker Carlson that the US is kind of the number one disinformation spreader, which I'm not saying the US doesn't engage in that too, but I don't think we do it at the scale or probably at the effectiveness of the Russians.
I think it depends on the topic you're talking about. I mean, I would make the arguments that COVID was by far the biggest example of disinformation in the entire world. Although, you know, an interesting thing about that is a lot of that was self-interested narratives. You know, you don't need to imagine a conspiracy. You just need to think, well, all right, a lot of people screwed up, and it's in their it's in their incentive to spread disinformation. And I'd also make the point, I think that that is a much more effective example. And why do I say that? Well, because public opinion in both US and EU is still, you know, over majority on Ukraine's side. Like, I'm just not convinced that the disinformation side of this stuff is actually as important as, you know, politicians being cowards and having bad, you know, bad incentives. Like, I'd be much more worried about what's, you know, as an example, like what ways Russia may have found to compromise, you know, US and EU politicians than I would about disinformation.
But they go hand in hand, right? Because you have the kind of like human access to politicians, which is one category. But then if you can foment a certain narrative in their base that they feel compelled they have to respond to, that's a compelling pairing of information warfare, in my opinion.
I don't think it's that important compared to other things. I mean, you know, a good example of this is like you got to go ask, all right, why hasn't Germany sent, you know, Taurus missiles to Ukraine? Why haven't they made those available? And, you know, the most compelling reasons to me seem like a whole bunch of bad incentives with US or with German politicians. That seems much more likely that to be a result of that than disinformation. And it's probably pretty boring stuff like, well, you know, they've done surveillance on politicians, they have ways to go blackmail them. Or, you know, also a big chunk of it being, well, they've paid them off by having like investments. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of German politicians who are very, very pissed off that, you know, they're not able to get natural gas from Germany or from Russia in the same volumes as they were before. And, you know, that screws up a whole lot of their plans. Like, doing that is unethical, but that is probably a more powerful thing than all of this disinformation. You know, and equally, like, the most powerful way to go stop that incentive is to make it very clear that, no, you're just never going to get natural gas or oil from Russia again. Well, how do you do that? Well, you blow up their fucking ports. You know, you destroy their infrastructure to make it impossible for that to ever happen again. Like, that's a much more powerful way of defeating these kinds of bad incentives than worrying about, you know, what people are saying on Telegram.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm processing that, actually, because I haven't heard it said that way. I mean, I certainly agree in the all the counteroffensive measures that you could take.
And another thing I'd say, like what you said earlier with like cyber attacks is, I mean, let's suppose hypothetically that this AT&T outage is due to Russia. Well, on the one hand, you know, that's not actually that effective. Like, you go bring down cell phone networks for a bit and, well, they go pop back up again when people go fix them. But on the other hand, the way you go defeat this is not by worrying about Russia. It's by making systems that aren't so fucking insecure. You know, why on earth was it even possible for AT&T to go down, you know, due to a cyber attack? Assuming, of course, that's the case. But if that's the case, why was that possible in the first place? Like, that's just a massive cybersecurity failure. And these things should be fixed by making systems that are stronger, not by worrying about what the Russians may or may not be doing.
I agree with you there, although it's a difficult challenge, right? Because there's an asymmetry to, you know, having to have perfect systems that operate, you know, up with perfect uptime compared to, you know, attacker just be right one time. What you look at, like,
yeah,
the Natanz,
but see, I actually disagree there. I think what we see in computer security, the asymmetry is in favor of the defender. Like, well, what so many of these cyber attacks show is actually just incredible levels of incompetence and laziness, you know, and also cost savings on the part of the people creating the software and creating the systems. Because you can very easily create systems that really are remarkably secure. I mean, Bitcoin's a great example. You know, without that much effort, Bitcoin has created a system where the actual underlying protocol has been effectively impenetrable for years. You know, we just haven't had problems with people creating fake Bitcoin in ways that are, you know, not easily detectable and fixable. And the equivalent for, like, so much cybersecurity stuff is certainly doable. And companies don't do it because they're trying to go save costs and they're, you know, not in a position where it matters enough. And again, that gets back to my point. Well, how effective was this AT&T attack? Actually not that effective. It didn't really do that much. You know, it gets fixed and then the system works again.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. Did you ever watch that awfully Orwellian movie that was funded by the Obamas, The Leave the World Behind, about the cyber attacks on the U.S.?
No, I never heard of it.
It's a Netflix. I don't recommend it. It's bad, but it's basically everything's horrible. Cyber attacks, everybody hates America. It was funded by the Obamas.
Yeah.
Ukraine, this goes on your point. Ukraine has been cyber attacked every week since the start of this war. I've heard between 200 and 500. I've heard different statistics, but it actually is a good point that Ukraine has been cyber attacked an unbelievable amount of times, and they've actually gotten stronger. It's amazing. I mean, I remember that first week, the reporters were amazed that the internet was still working. It's pretty wild if you think about it from that perspective.
But because cyber attacks have asymmetric security where, you know, you fix it once and then you're good forever for that particular way of attacking, like, you can defend yourself. Now, can Ukraine really defend itself indefinitely away, you know, from Russian air attack? No. Like, that's the difference. And this is why cyber attacks just aren't that important compared to the much more real physical attacks.
Interesting. So what else can they do? What else can they do to help? What else can we do besides donating money and Bitcoin?
You know, I hate to say it, but that is, like, finding ways to get more weapons to Ukraine. That is the thing, because you gotta solve the problem at the root source, and that is Russia continuing to be able to go fight. And, you know, and I'd say along those lines, probably the most like important component to this would be removing this idea that there needs to be restrictions on what Ukraine can target. Like, the fact that Ukraine can't take Western weapons and attack Russian targets on Russian soil is ridiculous. You know, you do not win wars by only fighting on your soil. It's an absurd, like, it's just truly absurd to limit yourself that way. You need to bring the fight to Russia, and you need to be doing things like destroying Russian industry. Like, we need the lights in Russia to go out. We need their industrial infrastructure to start failing. That is how you will win this war and achieve a lasting peace. You know, and the comparison is, well, how did we wind up in a position where the Nazis were defeated? By destroying German infrastructure to the point where they could not fight a war again. And, you know, that needs to be repeated in Russia. Like, that's just how it is. And, you know, for the people who say, well, but nukes, look, at every step of this phase, provided the US and the EU does their job, and the UK, I should point out too, they can always go and tell Russia, if you go try to go and attack first, all of Russia will be turned into glass. Like, that is how that discussion needs to play out. So, you know, there's your game theory there. do not go down that route, and you will still be better off at every step of this fit, you know, every step of this.
Yeah. I keep thinking though about what you're saying about making these strikes and counterstrikes deep in Russian territory. Those calls are indeed being made by, I mean, if it's going to be NATO supplied weapons, US supplied weapons and artillery, those are the calls. It's not Ukraine making that call. I mean, they're doing as much they can with the drones and the things that they have. But
and I got to point out, they have been doing that fairly effectively. I mean, there is good evidence that Russian oil exports have actually been gone down, and you know, in a double-digit percentage due to a Ukrainian tax on Russian oil and gas infrastructure. Like that is exactly what Ukraine needs to do, and you know, the rest of the world should help Ukraine do it. Similarly, the fact that Russian oil tankers aren't getting blown up is ridiculous. You know, you need more of them to mysteriously get destroyed at sea. Doesn't necessarily mean anyone has to take credit for it, but like it is a good thing if this stuff starts to happen. And just relying purely on sanctions is just not a good strategy.
What do you think about the state of Crimea after this, assuming even if Ukraine can win this battle of attrition and push them out? Ukraine will have a similar problem in defending Crimea, just as Russia is having, no?
Well, I think if Ukraine gets to the point where they have retaken Crimea, chances are that they are in a position in the war where defending it going forward is not that hard. I mean, as it is, like Ukraine's been so successful in taking out Russian naval assets that Crimea isn't actually that useful for Russia anymore. You know, like one of the theories, like sort of one of the theories of war, if you will, was Russia really wanted a naval base in Crimea. And Ukraine has already gotten to the point where Russia doesn't really, you know, doesn't usefully have a naval base in Crimea anymore. So I'm not too worried about that. And, you know, the most likely way this plays out is the war ends in a way where Russia's military and infrastructure is so degraded that, assuming Russia just doesn't entirely collapse, you know, deals can be made to go and put limits on that indefinitely until Russian culture changes.
Yeah, it's amazing how similar this is to history. I mean, if some people think there's like kind of nuance to this, but if you talk about Germany, as you said, being totally destroyed, having to suffer total defeat, you talk about Japan being totally destroyed, and the bottom line is they wanted, those were wars of conquest. It is true that America came to defend, and it took total destruction. And both of those cultures and countries have gotten back into the, you know, the, I don't know, the liberal, whatever you want to call it, liberal democratic Western orbit. And both are some of the, you know, two of the most successful countries. And
well, and you know, and I kind of make the point there, like, it's not like we achieve this with diplomacy. You know, Germany is a good example. Nearly as many German soldiers, not just Germans in general, German soldiers died as Jews were murdered. Like, it's, you know, of course, the numbers are a little fuzzy, but the estimates, like the good estimates are roughly 5 million German soldiers were killed in the war. And of course, as we all know, it was 6 million Jews. And when you then add the even more uncertain numbers for German civilians, it's probably somewhere between like 500,000 German civilians and maybe 3 million died on top of that. And of course, I would make the argument that civilian in this case should be put in quotes because, you know, if you're contributing to industry in a all-out war like that, you know, you're not really a civilian target anymore. You are part of the war effort. But, you know, the numbers were staggering. And of the population at the time, you know, a good example is like so many young German men were killed that dances, like social dances, had problems because there just weren't, you know, enough women for every man. Or sorry, there just weren't enough, you know, men for every woman. Like it was a severe asymmetry. And on top of all this, the way the war played out meant that the most Nazi-aligned parts of German society, they're the ones who died at the highest rates. You know, like an interesting example of this is the most fervent, like Nazi supporters tended to get shuttled off to U-boat service because, you know, submarines under the ocean, that is the least control headquarters have. Well, what's the death rate for German submariners over the course of World War II? Not that far from 100%. I think the number is like 70, 80% of them died. So like, it's not like, you know, we defeated the Nazis. We fucking slaughtered the Nazis. And then the remaining Nazis tended to die of old age and didn't pass on their beliefs to their children. Like, that's what it took to defeat Nazi Germany.
Yeah. And here's where I want to, and I have a question here following up, but this is where we need to remind our listeners about the history here, especially for Eastern Europe. It is true that Russia suffered horrible losses as well, defeating the Nazis on the Eastern Front, but that was after they allied with Hitler for the first 2 years of the war
yes.
and invaded Poland. Yeah. It's just that something Russia never acknowledges themselves internally.
Yeah.
They've never apologized for any of their occupations of Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So they're not.
It's interesting. Had World War II played out a little differently, it is quite possible that the Allies would have actually aligned with the remnants of the German army to then go defeat Russia. Because even then, people had figured out that Russia was evil.
You know, Operation Unthinkable, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah,
that was Churchill's plan. And Churchill actually, to his credit, I mean, Churchill was in the government in World War I. He wanted to go after and stop the Reds in World War I. Imagine if that had happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's all important history, important context. But here's my question. Russia has, they have nothing as far as a legacy of liberal democratic values, private property. They have nothing. They have 8 drunken years of Boris Yeltsin. That's all they have. So I completely agree with what you're saying. And if you don't understand that, like being in the West, that this is what you're dealing with. From the top down, there is nothing there for a liberal democratic West that respects private
property. Well, and I got to point out, I mean, I think the situation is actually a little worse than you're implying, because not only is there sort of none of this history, but the people who disagreed, they've tended to go leave Russia in enormous numbers. You know, Canada, as an example, is full of Russians who thought, fuck Russia, I don't like this system, I want to go move somewhere better.
Yeah, it's a pro and a con. There's 30 million Russians in abroad, and many of them, Putin looks at as his own. He wants to try to weaponize them. I know many are not, like you said.
I mean,
but many are.
I would push back on that a little. I think a lot of that's just purely, you know, it's not like, I mean, maybe the way to put it is it's not that Putin truly wants to do any of this stuff. It's that Putin. And, you know, and I should point out, like a lot, many other elements in Russian society and Russian government think this is a really good excuse to go and take shit from their neighbors.
Yep.
You know, did Russia really go and invade, Eastern Ukraine to go and save Russians there? No, they invaded Eastern Ukraine because of a few reasons, including the fact that there's a bunch of coal mines there and they get to go take over the coal and go and steal all that stuff and make a bunch of people rich.
Why did Hitler invade the Sudetenland?
Well,
protect those Germans. He had to protect those Germans. That's
yep,
the line.
And steal all other stuff. Well, you know, and of course Japan. I mean, when you look at the lead up to World War II, why was Japan going invading their neighbors? Well, one reason was go steal their oil.
So, I am in complete agreement with you here on the assessment and. I'm wondering what's on the other side of this. It's because any peace deal, as far as we're concerned in Eastern Europe, is just more time for Russia to regroup and go back on the offensive again in Ukraine and probably later in the Baltics, Poland, Finland, even Norway, maybe in certain levels. But,
Well, I would say the best.
Basically, just have to say it. It needs to be a total victory.
Yeah. Well, I'd say the most likely outcome. In the long run, and I say this because I think, you know, Ukraine and the rest of the world is going to win, is that Russia's economy gets gradually degraded to the point where it basically collapses again, and they don't really pose a threat. And the way that this goes forward from beyond that could easily be just indefinite economic collapse. You know, I mean, countries don't necessarily bounce back. I mean, one way this could play out is just Russia ends up being a failed state for the foreseeable future. until it's, you know, breaks apart into enough pieces that you don't even, that, you know, you're not even talking about Russia anymore. You know, and an example of this I'd point out is, like, I think, you know, Gaza in Israel is a similar situation where Gaza is the aggressor and trying to go and genocide Israel, but they're doing it at a much weaker position. And a likely outcome of this is just Gaza never becomes a state, and it's just a failed place for the definite future. And from Israel's point of view, great. You know, that'll keep them safe. We can do the exact same thing to Russia. Doesn't matter that Russia is big. The question is, you know, how functional is their economy? And their economy can stay collapsed indefinitely.
Yeah, what do you make of the, so just pulling out to the macro globally, so people make these comparisons, you know, about Western support and Western alliances, Israel with Gaza, you know, Taiwan, China, Russia, Ukraine, as the major flashpoints right now, but there have been others, you know, China, Philippines, right? There's several. Do you see, like, Ukraine as kind of the first line of defense globally for Western alliances?
Yeah, I unfortunately, like, it's not like it's a first line of defense militarily, but it's certainly a first line of defense in terms of signaling what you're willing to do for your allies. And, you know, like, sort of a, you know, counter, like an alternate version of history would have been if the West provided no support to Ukraine at all. China certainly would have been, you know, in a position to say, well, I mean, if the West isn't willing to do anything for Ukraine at all, I mean, chances are the West isn't willing to do anything for Taiwan at all, we can go and invade successfully. And fortunately, it's played out differently. But depending on how this plays out, maybe China will still go decide in the future that they can get away with invading Taiwan. And that would be a very, very, very bad thing for us.
I think that's a much different. So I see the, I agree with you, right? I think the vital interests that the U.S. would perceive in Taiwan are different from the ones in Ukraine. But I think the same principle holds, which is, what would we do for our allies? I think you're exactly right about that.
I mean, Taiwan is interesting because militarily, it's not like Taiwan, the islands, really does that much for anyone else. But Taiwan, the, you know, the country full of chip fabs, that's a very different discussion. And because Taiwan has developed into this very high tech, you know, very capable economy, they have, you know, created a situation for themselves where they are definitely worth defending.
Well, they call it the Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah, well, you know, an alternative way to go think about this course, if you're going to play Machiavellian, would be, well, you know, if Taiwan does get invaded, just destroy all the chip fabs and kill as many of the chip fab workers as possible or get them out of there, and then Taiwan's no longer an issue. But, you know, in that aspect, it definitely is different than Ukraine. But hopefully, you know, we don't get to that point.
Well, agreed. I think that would be much worse than any current global situation. But we also see, right, like, so TSCM building their fab in Arizona, which, you know, will take several years to be operational. However, my understanding, right, is, and this is just reading the news, they have gone right up to the edge of providing the most advanced semiconductor capabilities there. And they preserve that most advanced capability just for Taiwan Island as part of a self-defense mechanism.
Yeah, well, you know, the interplay there between Taiwan, the country, and TSMC is interesting because, you know, the company and the country are not necessarily going to be aligned on this. Like, from the country's point of view, they are probably better off if TSMC stayed solely within Taiwan. But from the company's point of view, they're probably better off if they diversify. And from the employee's point of view, again, they're probably better off if they diversify. So, you know, that's a complex situation there that I think doesn't have a good parallel in Ukraine at all. But, you know, certainly the less risk, less disruption way of dealing with all this is just make sure that Taiwan is sufficiently supported that invading them is unthinkable.
Yeah, well, you know, they've done a decent job of buying arms. I don't know that they've bolstered their army in the same sense, but they have F-35s and other advanced weaponry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's probably like, and also like, you got to think in terms of, you know, China, because they have nuclear weapons, is certainly in a position where they could destroy Taiwan. But that doesn't get them the benefit of taking it. And, you know, if I was in Taiwan's position, I certainly would be wanting to figure out a way to at least, you know, at least secretly develop nuclear weapons, go put China in the same kind of position. Because, like it or not, mutually assured destruction seems to work pretty well.
Well, don't the Taiwanese, that their proxy for nuclear weapons would be to bomb the Three Gorges Dam, which would have, you know, maybe even more deleterious effects than a nuclear attack.
It would certainly be a strategy, but, you know, I suspect bombing the Three Gorges Dam might be harder than you'd expect. I mean, frankly, even nuking the Three Gorges Dam is probably not actually that easy, because you have to somehow get the nuclear weapon far enough down that, you know, it actually goes off in a position where it can do some damage without being shot down by anti-air defense. You know, nuclear weapons are not magic. Like, they actually have to get to the place where they intend to go off. And, you know, unless you have extremely fast ballistic missiles, which themselves can still be shot down, you know, that's not an easy thing to do. You can certainly try smuggling them in, but that's a high risk operation too. So, you know, there aren't magic solutions there.
Yeah, we may come back to Ukraine here and Bitcoin, but I want to take another detour. You brought them up a few times. We've already talked about them, but Israel, Gaza. I just want to, in an effort to flush out all the philosophy and interesting discussion we're having here about war and defense and whatnot. I thought it was interesting your response to Peter McCormick, because I think a lot of people feel the way that Peter McCormick said about Gaza, that it you know, it's hard. Anybody would think that it's hard to look at what's happening right there to the people of Gaza. And you had a pretty strong response to him about Israel's right to defense. And I'm just wondering if you might elaborate.
Yeah, well, you know, an interesting example there is if you had asked me, say, you know, 3-4 years ago, what I would have thought between Israel and Gaza, you know, I would say at that moment, Israel was more in a, you know, was sort of more in the position of being morally wrong because of the West Bank settlers. But, you know, these things change due to actions by the people involved. And unfortunately, Gaza has decided to go down the route of war rather than peace. You know, they have decided to go attack Israel. They've done so, you know, they've done that in a way that's relatively ineffectually, you know, and of course, I don't want to go and I want to be careful there what I say there, because of course, they did go slaughter, I mean, over 1,000 Israeli civilians. Ironically, many of them, you know, the most sort of pro-Gazan elements of Israeli society, of course, you know, quite famously went to slaughter people at a music festival for peace.
Yeah.
But when you look at Israel as a whole, you know, does killing 1,000 Israelis directly threaten the Israeli state? No. But if you don't do anything, Gaza's going to do this again, and they're going to do this again, and they're going to do this again. They've said this very clearly, that is their goal. And because they have chosen to actually demonstrate this capability, they've also shown, you know, and Hamas and Gaza in general has shown that this isn't just bluster. Like, this is just political bluster. This is their actual genocidal intent. And in a situation like that, Israel has every right to say, fuck this. You know, we will not allow our civilians to be slaughtered again and again. And we will go take you out. Like it or not, they chose to go down the path of war. And once you've chosen to do that, the consequences are pretty severe for you when you do that against a country like Israel, which is just has a much stronger military. You know, unfortunately, the population of Gaza, every indication is that the majority of people do support Hamas. You know, they do believe that Jews are the enemy and that Jews need to be killed. Like, this is not a situation where a small minority is holding a large population hostage. This is where a large percent of the population, probably a majority, genuinely believes in this. You know, and like an example of this is how, at least prior to the prior to this kicking up, estimates are that about 8% of the entire adult male population of Gaza were actual Hamas fighters. Like 8%, you know, it's an enormous number.
Yeah. Although I wonder, so just kind of playing out a little game theory, and this is, I thought about this a little bit more right after October 7th, but so when they attacked, they knew that the counterpunch would be massive, right? That they had to have been planning for that and expecting and maybe hoping for what they would have thought would have been an Israeli, you know, air quotes, overreaction, right? They're going to come bomb a bunch of civilians, and that the worldview of Israel will be of, you know, that of an aggressor. But I also think maybe they were hoping for more of a regional response.
I suspect that's exactly it. Yeah.
And I wonder why, right? Like there's been sort of a semi-regional response, but not, I think, what Hamas was hoping for.
Well, I think what that comes down to is just Hamas found out the hard way that they don't have as many friends as they thought they did. And an example of this is like there's elements of Egyptian society and even in the Egyptian government that are very sort of pro-Hamas. But the way it plays out on the ground is Egypt has a massive fence with Gaza and they really do not want to let any Palestinians in. And you can argue that's kind of playing into Hamas's hands, but I think you can also make a good argument that this is genuinely because so much of Egyptian society and Egyptian government does not like Palestinians. You know, they do not like that kind of poking the eye of the bear behavior. You know, they don't like this violence that they're so willing to actually do in practice and that they're just not willing to be a part of it. You know, and it's also probably the case that Hamas's attack wound up being more brutal and more successful than they thought it would actually be. Like, I would not be surprised if Hamas leadership thought they would not be as successful in killing civilians as it actually played out. Because obviously, you know, you can imagine the lead up to the attack, they're training their people and so on. The rhetoric internally would be, yes, we will go slaughter the Jews, you know, we will go wipe them out. But they could have also, leadership could also been thinking, well, okay, how much will this really work? You know, probably like it'll be stopped to some extent. We'll maintain our control and power and we'll, you know, get some more help externally and we'll do something useful. But it probably won't actually work. And sure enough, Israel made a bunch of mistakes and it did work. And they went to slaughtered a music festival, among other things. Like, I would not be surprised that it didn't play out the way Hamas thought it would. And instead, it looked much more brutal than they expected, and they lost support that they thought they would get.
I think you're right. And there was a lot of commentary around this in the, you know, following the weeks after October 7th was the Israeli intelligence failure and the lack of immediate response and the failure of the kind of like technology on the border and the lack of personnel on the border. There were a bunch of criticisms, right? But I think had those been more effective, this would have never been, they wouldn't have gotten as far into Israel for as long as they did on that day.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, and you can imagine like if it played out differently, you know, it might have been maybe they'd managed to go kill a couple hundred Israeli military and then fewer civilians. And the focus was on the Israeli military and then the response. And then maybe they could, you know, maybe they thought they could go get more outside support from that.
Just want to push back just a little bit. I'm with you. 90% with you. I mean, Israel's right to defend themselves. What happened on October 7th was insane. And the response from certain Arab groups around the world, even before Israel did anything to defend herself, was pretty disgusting. So those things all I'm keeping in mind. But do you, just to provide a counterpoint, do you see the situation in Israel as quite a bit more nuanced and different than Ukraine? I mean, the occupied territories, the 67 borders, so on and so forth. I mean, Ukraine never invaded anybody in its 30-year independent history.
Well, you know,
is there anything there?
I think an important difference here is that Israel is genuinely in the wrong with the Israeli settlers. And there's no parallel like that in Ukraine. The Israeli settlers are the aggressor. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to say this in defense of the Israeli settlers, but I would kind of say this as an explanation. Unfortunately, I think the way this plays out is probably within Israel, Hamas has ironically given cover to Israeli settlers because they've kind of shown of the two evils, the Hamas side is probably the greater evil. And that makes it easier for the Israeli settlers to continue to commit their crimes of forcing Palestinians out. You know, and I'd also say, like, this is why, you know, I would say, like, this one reason why I do not think the U.S. and other countries should be sending military aid to Israel. You know, selling it's one thing, but, like, military aid, that those weapons are far better off used in Ukraine. I think would be a much better outcome if what they had basically told Israel would be just go blockade Gaza, don't allow food and water in, and, you know, let that play out. That would have been a much better position morally for, say, the U.S. to be in. And I think from Israel's point of view, it's absolutely acceptable for them to do something like that. You know, they have zero, like, they have no duty of care to the average person in Gaza. That is not their problem. They are quite, you know, they are perfectly, under international law, it's completely okay for them to just blockade the country until they surrender entirely. And I think that would have been a much better use of military resources than this, ironically, very sort of humanitarian-oriented thing of sending in IDF soldiers to carefully go and try to, you know, rescue hostages and avoid civilian casualties to the extent it's possible. You know, and that just uses a ton of resources that would be much better off in Ukraine actually fighting a, you know, a powerful enemy and, you know, saving the lives of people that are, frankly, a lot more worth saving.
Yeah, and this is kind of related, but I just want to make the point because I feel so strongly about Ukraine's independence here. So everybody knows, in case anybody forgot, is that Ukraine had multiple treaties signed with Russia, multiple border, not even disputes. Everything was settled. Crimea was always Ukraine. You can talk about some historical claim on Russia, but then you got to talk about Kaliningrad, because Kaliningrad was never Russia's. It's 800-year-old German-Prussian settlement. Headquarters of Prussia has... It's just the... The border thing, I may be unfairly using the Israel-Gaza situation, but if you want to say that's a gray area, nothing is unclear in the Russia-Ukraine situation. I mean, everything from the beginning was signed. They had a referendum in 1991. The vast majority of Ukrainians voted to leave the Soviet Union, which they, you know, the Socialist Party smoked out the independence movements in the early 1920s. They had to join the Soviet Union, but the, you know, the border, there's treaties, everything is crystal clear in the Ukraine situation. And we didn't do anything for 10 years. We didn't do anything. And you even get these blowhard, I don't even know what spectrum of the political arena to call them, like saying
contrarians.
Yeah. Contrarians. This sums it up, saying that, well, Russia's, you know, historically had a good feelings for Crimea, this and that. There's every possible agreement was signed there, as far as Crimea.
If they had such strong historical feelings, surely they could have had an open and fair vote, and this could have been handled with a few pieces of paper. But it didn't, because those feelings. Yeah, it didn't go that way.
1991, there was a referendum. Yes,
exactly. Yeah, and Russia lost that. Simple as that.
Yeah.
You know. Like they could have, like, I'm sure they could have arranged for another referendum. But of course, they weren't willing to do that in a fair way because they know they would have lost. And chances are they would have lost by an even bigger margin if they'd done this again in, say, the 2000s, you know?
Yeah.
This is why they had to go wait until they'd done an invasion so they could have a sham referendum.
Yeah. To the folks that are still want us to continue on the Israel-Gaza conversation, I apologize, but I have to keep using these examples to clarify the situation on Ukraine, because the situation in Ukraine is very simple in my eyes, and it needs to be explained more.
Like, Gaza is interesting there because, you know, Like, let's say that Gaza held a referendum. I am sure that a free and fair referendum in Gaza, or, you know, another election in Gaza would result in Hamas being elected again and Gazans wanting to go keep their country. Like that. That's where this situation diverges very strongly. But, you know, at the moment, does Israel have a war reparations claim on Gaza? Yeah. I mean, just like the value of the lives that, you know, Hamas went and slaughtered, you could probably easily buy up like half the real estate in Gaza right now, for damages. And, you know, a reasonable outcome of this could very well be that Israel just takes over a big chunk of Gaza, both as buffer zone and as punishment and, you know, compensation. And that's where something where, you know, it just doesn't look like Ukraine at all.
I have one about Bitcoin, Peter. Scale, just one.
Yeah.
I use this tweet of yours many times. I told you before, tweeted at you. You wrote this in August of 2018 in response to someone who's a bit Pollyannish on Lightning. August 2018, you wrote, "Money received in a Lightning channel isn't quite an IOU, but it's also not completely under your control. It's a middle ground state where the sender can attempt to take it back and under some circumstances may succeed." And as a fan of banking history, this is just a perfect explanation of why it's not quite the on-chain base money that Bitcoin is, but it's very much different as well than a bank account, which that's not under your control at all. So my question is, does that tweet still stand for you on Lightning, and is that the same relationship as any of the other proposals, covenants, other things?
Yes, so it's absolutely true for Lightning, and it's also the same relationship for all these other proposals. And if anything, my tweet might have oversimplified it a little, where I didn't really clearly point out that, what I said was certainly true for larger Lightning payments that are big enough to profitably be represented on chain. But for very small Lightning payments, like good example is, like, if I send you one Satoshi on Lightning, in the moment where that payment is actually happening, for a brief period of time, potentially not so brief if the payment gets delayed for a while, you know, that one Satoshi cannot really be represented on chain at all while the HTLC is still open. So in fact, that payment under those thresholds actually falls into more of a punishment thing, where it's like, if I send you that money and then I try to go defraud you by taking it back, basically speaking, what happens is I'll lose more than my Satoshi. You know, you don't necessarily get it back, but I will lose that money. And, you know, why this happens kind of gets down to the nuance of the dust limits and how HTLCs are represented and so on. But I think the big picture there is it's important to note that Lightning and things like that, they are a mix of either you can take your money back, or in some cases you can punish, you know, the person's punished enough that just isn't profitable to try to steal. But certainly the big picture there is, yes, this is fundamentally different in that degree than a purely on-chain transaction where the money is just there. Of course, but you know, also, even with an on-chain transaction, though, if you want to actually do anything with that money that you have on-chain, you still got to pay fees. And you can be in a position where fees are worth more than the UTXO is worth.
Indeed. And I think that overarching point there as well is that it's still, all of this is very much different than a bank account. So we're in a different world.
Yes.
It's good. But there are degrees here.
Well, with a bank account,
nuance.
Well, let's say, like with a bank account, the best you can possibly do is if the bank takes your money, you can go to a centralized third party, a court system, to try to get your money back. And whether or not that will work, good luck.
Indeed. All right. It's great. I know you got to run, Peter. As we close it, listen, thanks for the discussion. You know how strongly we all feel about Ukraine's independence here. Any final thoughts on supporting Ukraine, Israel, anything else?
I mean, I think I'll repeat what I said earlier. You know, the hardest part about being contrarian is knowing when the majority is right. You know, if you guys are into flat earth theory and like 9/11 wasn't taken down by airplanes, like, man, you know, think for yourself. Don't just reflexively react against everyone else.
Wise words. Thank you, Peter. Really appreciate it. Hopefully we can speak again in a couple of years and maybe under better circumstances.
Yeah, I hope so. All right. Talk later.
Take care.
Cheers, man.
Bye-bye.